early days of Seattle, cheap lumber piled high. Buildings built on stilts escaped the floods and tide. Homes, pubs, and warehouses flourished near the shore. The wharves were filled with ships. There was plenty in the stores. In a cabinet shop on Front Street, spilled glue began to burn. Throw your coat on the flame, a worker called in turn. Before it could be done, some water first was tried. The glue exploded everywhere, the men began to cry. Fire, fire, the cry was everywhere. The bucket brigades were running around, fire everywhere. The volunteers did their best to try and stop the flames. With water pressure low, they were losing all the same. Hollowed logs for pipes brought the water very slow. The drought had dried the city and the wind began to blow. The flames spread so fast, nothing could be done. Many blocks had burned before the setting sun. It burned the shacks on Skid Road and the bubbles soon were gone. Liquor stores exploded and the mighty fire roared on. Fire, fire. Fire was everywhere.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 52, History of Robber's Roost and the Fire of 1889. In episode 50, I retackled the Great Spokane Fire and also talked about the Davenport Hotel, which rose from the ashes of that great conflagration. I didn't do that story justice initially when it came to the Spokane portion, and I also didn't do all that well with handling the Ellensburg fire that occurred just a month prior. My intentions with today's episode is to rectify that problem and to expand upon what I started back in December of 2020. I'm also going to talk a little about the history of Ellensburg, which was initially given the name Robber's Roost, which is why I chose to call it that in the episode. The Kittitas Valley is where Manistash Creek and the Yakima River come together, and it's also been the place for generations where Native Americans of the Kittitas and Yakima bands gathered, along with other Columbia Plateau tribes. The surrounding area was important to these tribes, who, when meeting there, gathered camas roots and sweet onions. They also grazed their horses, who in these tribes were treated like family and with the utmost respect, and also raced them for friendly yet competitive sport. It was also here where they settled small disputes, forged close family ties, feasted, and played various games. The first non-native inhabitant of the area that eventually became Ellensburg was one of the first priests to be ordained in what would become the Evergreen State, a man by the name of Father Charles Pandesi, a missionary of Mary Immaculate. In July of 1848, Father Pandesi built a small and crude structure that was intended to house the mission, which was called Immaculate Conception on Manistash Creek. He served at this crude mission for just over a year, and in his time there, he found little success in converting the area's indigenous peoples. It's believed by most that the mission deteriorated under natural conditions, but some people think it was burnt down by the United States Army during the Treaty Wars of 1855 and 1856. The Army had previously burned down another Oblate mission that the father had served at. This mission was located on Autanum Creek near present-day Union Gap. The soldiers wrongly believed that Father Pandesi was supplying the natives with gunpowder. Starting in 1859, Ben Snipes, a cattleman, and his wranglers began driving cattle through the Kittitas Valley near the present-day site of Ellensburg. These cattle were headed towards Canada's Fraser River. Following in Ben Snipes' footsteps, other cattlemen began to drive their cattle through the valley, some of these bound for the Caribou Mines of British Columbia, and then, later on, they were headed towards the big markets in Seattle and Tacoma. The area had an abundance of both clean water and bunch grass, which made the location ideal for the cowboys to rest up their cattle before driving them over the Cascades. 1867 saw a man by the name of William Willis build a small cabin near the creek that now bears his last name. Of William, the 1919 History of the Yakima Valley, Washington book had this to say: "Hardly a real settler, certainly not a builder in any true sense. He seems to have been simply a renegade, consorting with the natives and finally losing his life in connection with too close an attachment to some other man's horses." Andrew Jackson Splawn, both known as AJ and Jack, was an interesting man, and I'm going to talk a little more about him now before I get on with Ellensburg's story. I'll tie it back into the main story when I wrap it up. I won't take long, I promise. Jack Splawn was a cowboy that drove cattle through the Kittitas Valley towards the goldfields of British Columbia. He was also a good friend of some of the local Native American chiefs, but one of his biggest claims to fame is that he was an early mayor of the town of Yakima. He was born in Missouri on the 30th of July of 1845. By the time young Jack was 6 years old, his father had died, leaving his mother a widow to take care of Jack and his several siblings. It was when Jack was 6 years old that his mother decided it was time to pack up the family and move them west along the Oregon Trail. The family made it to the Willamette Valley, and young Jack lived at home until he was 15 when he struck out with his older brother. They wound up in the tiny settlement of Goldendale and found themselves a cabin. It was at this time that an interesting event occurred in the life of Jack Splawn. One night, a girl named Lalu, who was a member of the nearby Klickitat tribe, came by to warn Jack and another man to get out of town since some other Native Americans were planning on killing Jack and his unnamed acquaintance. Lalu told the pair that her father was delaying these people as best as he could, and she then proceeded to guide the two men to safety. To show his gratitude for the young woman that saved his life, Jack would later name his daughter after Lalu. A couple months after this event, Jack was hired on with Major John Thorpe. He was to help move the Thorpe family to the Yakima Valley near Moxie. Jack would later do some additional work for Thorpe, which mainly involved driving cattle towards the British Columbia goldfields. It was during this first drive that Jack later recalled that Columbia Chief Moses had persuaded a band of Native Americans to leave him alone. This thwarted their plans to murder him and his help and drive off their cattle. Jack Splawn would write later that Moses told the warriors that Splawn was no cowardly dog to be killed. This first drive for Jack turned out to be quite eventful for him, when later on, Splawn was forced to kill a native who had tried to run off some of the cattle. This initially caused Okanagan Chief Tenasket to want to kill Splawn in revenge. He would change his mind, though, when he learned that the man belonged to a different band of natives, and the man was also a known horse thief. Instead, doing a complete 180 in his thinking, Tenasket had a few of his warriors escort Thorpe and Jack through his territory. Jack's career in the cattle running business continued for another 9 years after his first run. He typically followed the first trip and ran cattle from the valley to British Columbia. As backbreaking, grueling, and dangerous as this probably was, how awesome would it have been to see the area at that time when there was hardly any development at all? Must have been pretty peaceful at times if Jack wasn't dealing with hostile people or animals looking for a snack. On a return trip through the Palouse country in 1865, Splawn and his friend Willis Thorpe stopped at a Native American dwelling seeking help to find a trading post. A very old Native American gentleman said he knew the way, so Jack and Willis hired this man as a guide. The trio talked as they traveled, and when Jack told the old man that the pair was in fact headed back home to the Yakima Valley, the old man's eyes instantly lit up and he began to excitedly question the two men about the white settlements and the prominent natives of the valley. He quickly added that he knew of them when he lived near the mission at Autanum Creek. It was only when the trio made it to the trading post that Jack and Willis learned the identity of this old man. The trader addressed him as Kamiakin. Jack Splawn must have been a little surprised. When he asked this man if he was indeed the legendary Yakima chief, Kamiakin stood ramrod straight and said indeed he was, and told the men that he had fought valiantly for his country until his warriors either lost their lives in battle or deserted him. He then said after that he had left for Rock Lake. Kamiakin went on to proudly say, "There is no more war. I wish to live in peace until the Great Spirit calls me to take the long trail." It was in 1870 that Jack and Ben Birch hired Martin Davern to move Willis's old cabin to a site that is now in the middle of East 3rd Avenue between North Main Street and North Water Street in Ellensburg. Jack expanded his business interests with this cabin by establishing a trading post which was known as Robber's Roost. This was the first business in Kittitas County. See, I told you I'd get back to the point, but I'm still not quite done with old Jack yet. Many years after Jack Splawn sold Robber's Roost to John Shouty, he wrote in his memoir, "When we got to unloading our stuff, the cabin was so full it looked like there would be no room inside for customers. John Gillespie, a young settler of the previous year and a good friend of mine, rode up and asked how I was going to get inside to do business. I told him I should sell first the goods nearest the door and then gradually work my way in. He said I needed a sign and volunteered to make me one. I accepted his offer. A few mornings later, I read over my door, Robber's Roost. It staggered me for a moment, but on second thought, I concluded that perhaps John knew more about the sign business than I did. Though it did look very suggestive, I decided to let it stay." Robber's Roost thrived for the next 2 years when Jack sold the store in 1872 to John Shouty, in addition to his squatter's rights on 160 acres of land. Jack Splawn felt the call of the wild and wanted to get back to his wandering roots. He said, "The call of the mountains and the plains was too constant and too strong for me to remain in any one place for too long." This land would later come to be named Ellensburg, which was named for John Shouty's wife, Mary Ellen. You can actually find a marker on West 3rd Street by the records printing office, and it marks the Robber's Roost location from nearly 150 years ago. But before I get back to talking about Ellensburg, I wanted to talk a little more about Jack Splon's life. Because after he sold Robber's Roost, his life gets really interesting. Jack ended up going back to the cattle business, and in the 1880s, he introduced Hereford cattle to the Pacific Northwest. Around this time, he also got pretty heavily involved in the fruit industry, and he promoted the first packing house that was ever built in the Evergreen State. Jack Splon was living in Cowichi by the early 1900s when he decided to start dabbling into the world of politics. He would be elected to the Washington State Senate in 1903. He would represent Yakima County and served in that position for 2 years until 1905. The next year saw Jack making an unsuccessful bid for governor on the Democratic ticket. Staying busy, in 1907, Jack joined with other area businessmen to establish the Yakima Valley Transportation Company, which provided trolley service in the rapidly growing city. Splon served as the president of the new company and drove the trolley for its inaugural run on Christmas Eve of 1907. In 1911, Jack moved to North Yakima and became that town's first mayor under the new form of commission government. He would hold this political post for 4 years until 1915. His administration is noted for cleaning up the rampant opium dens and got sex workers out of the central part of the city. After his 4 years as mayor was up, Jack then went on to serve for a year as chief of police for North Yakima. Jack Splon died on the 2nd of March, 1917, after he reportedly contracted a disease from a parrot in a pet store. Man, what a way to go out. In my research, I've never seen that exact kind of death reported. He's buried in Tahoma Cemetery in Yakima, not the National Cemetery in Kent, I might note. Now, I'll get back to Ellensburg, but wasn't Jack's life pretty fascinating? I didn't really know all that much about him before I started my research for this episode, so it was pretty fun to learn. John and Mary Shouty, who I briefly mentioned a minute or two ago when talking about Jack Splon, first arrived in the Kittitas Valley from Seattle in 1871. John's sister was married to Seattle banker and pioneer Dexter Horton. Both John Shouty and Dexter Horton were among a group of Seattle businessmen and investors who were attempting to create a wagon road over Snoqualmie Pass. John would go on to purchase the stock of goods that Jack Splon had available at Robber's Roost, which included the trading post and squatter's rights I mentioned earlier. After this purchase, John Shouty went on to build a two-story frame building to house the trading post business, and it's more than likely that he and his young family ended up living in the old Willis cabin. Later in 1872, a blacksmith shop was built near the store by a gentleman by the name of Jacob Becker. Over the first several years of the settlement, these two businesses and a few small houses comprised the entirety of this town. In 1875, John Shouty platted the town site, which he had named Ellensburg, ending with an H, as was the fashion at the time. This H would be dropped by the post office in 1894, and the town has retained the spelling to this day. The plat for John and Mary Ellen Shouty was filed on the 20th of July of 1875. Just a few years later, in 1878, the small town boasted its first saloon and its first practicing doctor, Dr. Middleton Amon. And by the winter of 1881, the first public school sessions were held. Growth up until this point was relatively slow, but that was about to change. Ellensburg's location, even from those early days, was advantageous to its continued growth. At first, a simple footpath crossed Snoqualmie Pass, then that was widened into a wagon path, then eventually a road, and now a major interstate highway, and Ellensburg bore witness to them all. It is the prime jumping-off point to points in all directions. 1883 saw the town's first bank begin business, as well as its first fire station being built and manned. Later that same year, on the 23rd of November, Kittitas County was established, with Ellensburg being named the county seat. New Year's Day of 1884 saw the Territorial Act that ratified Ellensburg's incorporation, and now this town was officially an incorporated city. Growth would begin to boom from here. Later the same year that incorporation came into effect also saw a private Presbyterian school called the Ellensburg Academy start classes. In late 1884, General C.B. Lamborn of the Northern Pacific Railroad chose Ellensburg to receive a depot in the future. In agreement for this, John Shouty and other area settlers gave the company some land in exchange for the depot being built. The Ellensburg Depot would be completed in 1886. Around the time that the depot was completed, Ellensburg held its first city elections, with Austin Miles being elected the first mayor. A county courthouse was opened the next year, and by early 1889, growth for Ellensburg seemed to know no bounds. There were even rumors going around that the city might even be the capital for the soon-to-be Washington state, but those rumors were simply pipe dreams at best. The 1889 population was about 2,500 people, with an additional 20 plats being filed that year and the prior year. With this growth and the continued attraction of the area, the Northwest Magazine, which was published by the Northern Pacific and distributed aboard its trains, compiled over 13 pages to Ellensburg, surely helping to fuel the growth of the new city. In case you never listened to episode 1 of this podcast, or episode 50, 1889 was a very dry summer for the Evergreen State, and things were no different in Ellensburg. Seattle had just burned to the ground in its devastating fire, so people around town must have been just a little on edge when July of 1889 rolled around. The Ellensburg fire began on the 4th of July in the late evening. The flames were first noticed by people attending a Knights of Pythias dance at the Johnson House Hotel. The fire department responded promptly, but strong northeast winds prevented them from halting the advance of the conflagration. Fanned by these strong winds, the fire quickly consumed the store and spread to adjoining wood frame structures. The wind-whipped fire soon got hot enough that even stone buildings were destroyed. Among the casualties were the saloons on the north side of 4th Avenue, which one first-hand account described as crumbling like eggshells. Help was telegraphed for from the surrounding towns, but long before that help could reach the scene, the flames had literally wiped out the entire heart of the city and commenced to spread amongst a portion of the residential area of Ellensburg on the south side of the city. Not until the main portion of fuel that sustained the fire had been consumed were there any signs of slowing, and it was nearly 3 a.m. before the firemen had secured any results from their tireless and grueling firefighting efforts. The fire lasted from about 10:30 p.m. to 3:30 a.m. the next morning and destroyed over 200 homes and buildings, including over 10 blocks in the heart of the city of nearly 4,000 people. Nearly half of those destroyed buildings had been constructed in only the previous 2 years. By the time it was over, miraculously, nobody was killed during the fire, but over 100 families were made homeless, penniless, and left with nothing to their names but the clothes on their backs. This news is especially good when you consider that the fire started quite late and most people in the homes that burned were sleeping when the fire first burst to life. All these people were awakened due to the cacophony the fire and the gathering crowds were making. The devastation made news throughout the region, with newspapers describing the ruined city in great detail. Observers who had toured Seattle after its recent fire said that the Ellensburg fire ended up destroying more property and causing more damage in less space. Losses were estimated to be more than $2 million, equivalent to over $52 million today. John Shouty's original corner, which featured the first wood-framed building in Ellensburg, was a total loss and reduced to absolute rubble. Another building many thought would survive, the Snipes Bank, was completely gutted, but the outside stone facade remained mostly intact. Many of these surviving stones were in fact used again when a building was constructed in the exact location, which was located on the southeast corner of 4th Avenue and Pearl Street. The rebuilt building ended up just as massive and ornate as the original. This one even included some office space that was available for rent. After World War II, the stone facade of the building was removed and replaced with more modern, also called ugly, plaster and marble. The sole surviving building in the downtown area was the Lynch Block, which still stands to this day. It was built by John Nash in 1888 for almost $20,000. The city courthouse survived due to the fact that it ended up being upwind from the destructive flames. Like the Great Seattle Fire before it, the residents of the city rebuilt the downtown area quite rapidly in the following months. Almost happening overnight, the burned-out section went from smoldering ruins and ashes to bustling scenes of cleanup and construction. They were so eager to get this process going that within 6 days of the embers being extinguished, foundations and walls of buildings were already being erected. Many of the wood frame buildings that were destroyed in the blaze ended up being replaced with buildings of brick and stone construction, with many of them still standing to this day in Ellensburg's historic downtown district, including the Cadwell Building, which houses the awesome Kittitas County Historical Museum, and the Geddes Building. The reconstruction was aided by the proximity to the Northern Pacific Railway, which made the task of getting the much-needed building supplies into the city more easy. The time of the blaze led to suspicion that it was related to the holiday fireworks, although the owner of the grocery store where the fire began speculated that it might have been started by Native Americans in revenge for a white man beating a Native American woman. Other people also felt that the store could have been to blame when a copper still was discovered in the ruins of the store's basement. A news account from about 15 years ago claimed rather dubiously that local citizens found red cards with "You have no pity, we show no mercy" written on them in their yards the next morning. The director of the Kittitas County Historical Museum says the list of possible causes for the fire includes errant fireworks, insurance fraud, two faulty electric lights, drunken striking minors, vagrants displaced by the Seattle fire, disgruntled Native Americans or Chinese, even a disgruntled circus that had tried and failed to set up their tent on the edge of town in the high winds that were blowing that day, were blamed for potential culprits for the start of the catastrophic blaze. The fact that the true cause of the blaze is unknown is not that uncommon. I doubt we'll ever learn the truth of the matter, so it's like having a little unsolved mystery right here in the Evergreen State. 1890 saw construction on most of the new buildings being completed, which included the Phoenix Block, actually named the Davidson Block. Most call it the Phoenix due to the fact that there was a statue placed on the building's 4th Avenue side, which symbolized the city's rebirth from the destruction of the fire the previous year. The Davidson Block is by far the most heavily photographed and most recognizable building of the historic downtown district of Ellensburg. This iconic building was designed by J.B. Randall and was built by John B. Davidson for a total cost of $42,000, which today is about $1.25 million. The brick it was built of was shipped in from Chicago, and it was completed by January of 1890. Businesses have always occupied this bottom floor of the building, going back 131 years since it was opened. Various hotels have occupied the upper floor. The corner room of the hotel has always been a favorite and has always been heavily requested. It is no surprise that this room, of course, is the most expensive. Another iconic building of the rebirth period of Ellensburg is the Cridle Building, which was constructed during the fall and winter of 1889. It's located on the northeast corner of 3rd Avenue and Pearl Street. Unfortunately, but a good thing safety-wise for the building, was that it was modernized in the 1940s, meaning its beautiful stone tower and ornate facade was removed and replaced with something, in my opinion, that is just a little more drab and boring. One of the most comfortable and accommodating businesses in the Northwest in its time opened its doors for business when the 95 steam-heated rooms of the Hotel Horton opened in 1890. The structure was built by two men from Kansas named John Moffett and W.M. Dignan. To show their support for this endeavor, the citizens of Ellensburg contributed $5,000 towards the construction of the building, with an additional $50,000 in private funds being used. This hotel was actually in the final stages of construction when the fire swept through the city. It survived unscathed and was able to open right on schedule. It was located on the southwest corner of 6th and Pearl Streets. This large two-story hotel was advertised as being heated by steam and fully lighted by electricity. Sadly, after being renamed the Antlers Hotel, it burned to the ground in spectacular style in October of 1967. You can bet I'll share some pictures of this event on the Facebook page. 1890 brought a somewhat expected blow to the city's hopes. The rumors I mentioned earlier that Ellensburg might become the new capital of the new state were dashed when Olympia, which was the territorial capital, was announced as the capital of the Evergreen State. Despite this massive growth immediately after the fire, the business outlook in the town began to turn south, and some businesses even ended up closing their doors and leaving town. The following 2 years were no better, and even more businesses began closing their doors. When the worldwide financial panic of 1893 struck, Ellensburg was already falling, so it struck hard and did not help the economic condition of the city at all. Ellensburg was very ill prepared for this downturn, and perhaps handled it the worst of any town in the Evergreen State. Progress of any kind for the town was out of question. The Ben Snipes Bank that I briefly talked about earlier, which was rebuilt using some of its original stone, failed in 1893, and not a single one of its claimants received more than 10% of the money that was rightfully owed to them. Ellensburg's situation began to look up by the end of the 1890s, though. When John Shouty built an early lighting system, the city would later acquire it in 1890 and began to improve upon it. When it went into operation, the Ellensburg Light Department was the Evergreen State's first municipally owned and operated lighting system. In 1926, they partnered with Puget Sound Power and Light to provide more power for the city, and by 1951, the operator had been completely replaced by the Bonneville Power Administration. Also getting its start back in 1890 was the Washington State Normal School in Ellensburg, when it was established by a bill signed by the first governor of the Evergreen State, Elisha P. Ferry. It opened its doors for the first students in temporary buildings in 1891. Its name would then be changed to the Central Washington College of Education in 1937 and finally got its current name of Central Washington University in 1977. From the time construction began to today, the university has been a major source of employment for the town. The first telephone service also arrived on the Ellensburg scene in 1890. What a year for the city, coming off the fire and seeing all of these wonderful new technologies taking root. Being able to stay in a heated and fully lit hotel, which was probably its early guests' first time ever seeing electricity being used on such a large scale, must have been amazing. Some of these guests might have even been able to place a phone call, though the people they knew to call were probably very limited. The Sunset Telephone and Telegraph Company was the provider, which was a part of a larger telephone conglomerate. In 1908, it became the Ellensburg Telephone Company. It was in operation well into the 2000s. Ellensburg was a town with a capital T for many of the farms and ranches that littered the Kittitas Valley and the surrounding areas. It was a place where friends and family came to meet, mingle, resupply, and gossip. The area began with cattlemen finding it a lush place to stop and rest and feed their herds, and that never really changed for Ellensburg in the valley, but instead of being nomadic and just passing through, over time ranches and farms were built and the area gradually became known for its beef and fruit production. Its high-quality Timothy hay has been much praised over the years by farmers. In 1910, town residents voted to approve the curation of a municipal water system, which replaced the privately owned Ellensburg Water Company that was started 25 years prior. With its role as a social hub for the valley and surrounding areas, it's no wonder that Ellensburg was home to many social organizations over the years. To name a few, the Masons, Elks, and Lions for larger nationwide organizations, and even included smaller organizations like the Straight Arrow Pioneer Society, the Friday Club, and Mother's Club. I couldn't talk about Ellensburg without talking a little about the awesome rocks you can find here, which are agates called Ellensburg Blues. This unique and beautiful agate is considered to be a semi-precious gem. It can only be found in northwest Kittitas County, particularly around Green Canyon and Reeser Creek roads. Ellensburg Blues range in color from a light sky blue, my favorite hue, to an almost purple royal blue. They were first discovered in 1905 by a farmer, who also just so happened to be the first mayor of Ellensburg that I mentioned earlier, Austin Wares. He reportedly sent two amazing pieces to a Seattle jeweler and had them made into rings. A jeweler in Ellensburg from the middle 1910s to the 1940s, named J.N.O. Thompson, helped to popularize these gem-like stones, and they were his go-to gem at his shop in town. His son later became a geologist and later wrote a book on these awesome agates. For a time in the 1920s, Tiffany's even became interested in these blues and promoted them all over the country. The Kittitas County Historical Museum, which opened in 1961, has had an exhibit on them since opening. House Bill 2757, which ultimately went nowhere, was proposed and called for the renaming of the Washington State Gem to be switched to the Ellensburg Blue, with petrified wood being given the new title of the vegetative fossil of the state of Washington. Though the fact that the bill passed the state house with 91 yeas and 7 nays, the state senate never got to hear the bill due to a missed deadline. The fact that these can only be found in such a limited range, they are frequently referred to as blue gold and are mainly sold to jewelers to be cut and made into beautiful jewelry. Ellensburg blues are chemically distinct from other blue agates due to variations in their trace elemental chemical signatures and crystallography, and are a vein-hosted mineralization. They form when fluid pressurizes deep inside the earth and cracks up a solid chunk of basalt. The fluid then moves up the crack, mineralizes, and grows out from the walls and into the middle of the crack. Geologists at Central Washington University theorize that there was probably an ancient river that brought these agates from up behind First Creek, where it was thought that they were initially formed. A lot of rock eroded off the top of First Creek, so that's where the blues separated out, and that's what people have been finding since 1905. The ones for sale you will typically find are not of the utmost quality and are raw. The problem of fraud has also risen up around these, which can sometimes go for as much as $250 per carat. A common deception is when blue lace agate is taken and shaped to look similar to that of Ellensburg blue and sold for much more than what it actually would sell if they knew what they were actually buying. Since rock hounding peaked in the 1970s, it has become increasingly more difficult to find these beautiful and elusive agates. Three chimpanzees were moved to the Central Washington University, and the Chimpanzee and Human Communication Institute was founded by Deborah Fouts and Roger Fouts. The next year, two more chimpanzees joined the bunch, bringing their numbers at the university up to 5. Originally, these chimps were housed on the third floor of the university's psychology complex. Roger and Deborah, along with their students, continued to advocate for the chimps and lobbied the campus and state legislature for a specialized facility to properly care for and study these remarkable animals. Their wish would be granted, and the new facility opened in May of 1993. 20 years later, the facility saw its last two chimpanzees leave for Quebec, signaling the end of chimps on campus after over 30 years. The Kittitas County Fair, which was first held in 1885, was held sporadically at various locations on the outskirts of Ellensburg. After more than three decades of this unsure setup, the 1921 and 1922 fairs were highly successful and finally convinced civic leaders to create a permanent home for the fair. Folks from all around the valley gathered on a June weekend in 1923 and commenced the process of clearing brush and grading land in an area below and just north and west of Craig's Hill. Thanks to their effort and the work of construction workers following the weekend, the Kittitas County Fair finally had its own permanent, purpose-built facilities. The same year, the first fair was held at its new grounds, saw the beginning of an Ellensburg institution. The first official Ellensburg Rodeo was held in conjunction with the fair from the 13th of September to the 15th. Other events in the past have included smaller scale events with rodeo-like spectacles, but this particular event was considered to be the first official rodeo at the fair. This initial rodeo was only intended to help draw extra crowds to the fair. It was a near-instant hit and drew sellout crowds for its 2 days. It quickly went on to establish itself as a major event over the next 98 years. 2023 will mark the 100th anniversary of this legendary event, and I sure hope they do something special for that, because that would be pretty sweet. The Ellensburg Rodeo continues to draw sellout crowds, with some years seeing crowds swell to nearly 40,000 people. It draws world-class competitors and has been listed by the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association as one of the top 25 paying rodeos in the entire country. I wanted to conclude today's episode by talking a little about my favorite food joint in Ellensburg, the iconic Campus U-Totem Burgers. They didn't pay me to say this, but if they want to, I'm not going to say no. Whenever my wife and I are in town, we have to stop and get some of their delicious cheeseburgers. Campus U-Totem was started in the early 1950s and survived the turbulent 60s, the grunge of the 90s, and is still slinging out some of the best burgers in the state. So if you're ever in town and have a hankering for a delicious old-school burger, check out Campus U-Totem. It'll be worth it. It's freaking delicious. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Sources for this episode include HistoryLink.org, The Spokesman Review, The Seattle Times, The Daily Record News, Episode 1 of The History of the Evergreen State, The CW Observer, and Wikipedia. Thank you for listening to Episode 52, History of Robber's Roost and the Fire of 1889. Episode 53 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please don't hesitate to contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C. Stay safe out there, everyone.
The bucket for days were running around, fire everywhere. The fire marshal was gone on a trip to Frisco Bay. The mayor took control, the inferno had its way. Now just a smoldering pile, the bustling town was gone. The people, not the rats, were saved. Seattle would live on. The Great Seattle Fire in 1889. Cedar buildings burning, one block at a time. All because some glue spilled and burst into flame. The rainy Emerald Town would never be the same. Fire, fire, there was fire everywhere. The bucket trays were running around, fire everywhere. Fire, fire, fire was everywhere. The bucket trays were running around, fire everywhere. Rudyard Kipling, a famous English poet, arrived by ship that very next day. Here's what he had to say. A horrible black smudge as though a hand had come down and rubbed the place smooth. I know now what being wiped out means.